The headlines, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says verification of sanctions, removal and reliable guarantees will form the basis of any agreement reached in the Vienna talks. A new video released by a U.S.-based organization documents Israel's crimes in Palestine, noting that the Israeli forces killed 78 Palestinian children in 2021. South Korea, Japan say the North has fired a suspected ballistic missile toward the East Sea in what can be Pyongyang's seventh missile test this month.
Welcome to the program.
Iran's president says his country has proven its will and seriousness in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ebrahim Raisi said the verifiable removal of anti-Iran sanctions will provide the basis for an agreement. He said the other negotiating parties must provide guarantees that they will not withdraw from the pact in the future. Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron. For his part, said that Iran has the right to distrust the United States, as it was Washington that threw the JCPOA into disarray. He was referring to the unilateral withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal in 2018. Iran and the remaining parties have been trying to revive the agreement. Britain, France, and Germany say the talks are in their final stages and that political decisions need to be made now. Let's get you some proper reaction into that story through the help of Mr. Robert Fentina. He's an author and journalist who comes to you live via Skype out of Kitchener, Ontario. Thank you very much, Robert, for joining us. How do you reflect on this? It by itself should show that perhaps we are entering a new phase, not only for the negotiations, but how the world wants to deal with the JCPOA.
Yes, I think we perhaps are. And the Iranian government is completely reasonable in saying that they need assurances that other parties, specifically the United States, will not unilaterally withdraw again. During the time that the JCPOA was in effect, all parties were maintaining it. Iran was being, the Iranian sites were being inspected, reports were being given to the U.S. Congress as the U.S. Mandated as part of the agreement, and it was to everyone's benefit. Trade was going back and forth between the nations, the sanctions had been lifted, and then Donald Trump unilaterally, and I might add illegally, withdrew from the agreement and reimpose the sanctions. The other parties failed to then keep their part of the agreement. The government of Iran maintained its part of the agreement for a full year afterwards. So now, with these latest remarks and the fact that the other signatories are saying that it's time for political decisions and that, as you said, we're entering a new phase, it is time to conclude this. But the conclusion will come about when the United States decides to remove all the sanctions before Iran makes any efforts to reduce its nuclear enrichment, because it is the United States that violated the agreement. Those are the political decisions that must be made on the part of the U.S. and part of the other signatories. And one of the issues is that in the U.S., in the Biden administration, there are people who are simply pushing for war against Iran.
And exactly, you know, you said it. It's within the administration and actually outside his administration, people are saying that. If I'm not mistaken, Senator Tom Cotton just a few days ago said that if there is a new agreement, we're going to rip it off again if we come to power, if that is the Republicans come to power after Mr. Biden. So your idea on that, how achievable do you think those political decisions that we just spoke about really are, you know, given these skirmishes within the U.S. administration itself?
With those kind of comments coming from U.S. Congress, Iran has no reason to re-enter the agreement. Part of Iran's major concern is having an assurance that the United States will not once again unilaterally withdraw, and yet members of the U.S. Congress are saying they're going to do exactly that. So the U.S., if it wants to reinstate the JCPOA, which around the world was considered a positive agreement. The only places where it wasn't considered were in some aspects of U.S. Congress and in some aspects of the Israeli government. But if they want to reinstate it and have this agreement come into effect again, there are going to have to be some major concessions by the United States to show its good faith. The government of Iran has already showed its good faith and goodwill by maintaining the agreement for a full year afterwards. The United States has done nothing but show bad faith, and it's proven that it cannot be trusted.
Are you hopeful they're going to do it this time?
I'm not, unfortunately. Biden is not a strong leader. He knows that he is, the Democrats have just minimal control of Congress right now. The elections that take place later this year will probably move Congress back to Republican control, which certainly the government of Iran is aware of. And Biden is not a strong enough leader to make the commitments that he needs to make in order to reinstate this this agreement, which kept the Middle East away from another war. But the United States doesn't really care about having wars or not.
Mm-hmm. Many, many thanks, Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist out of Kitchener, Ontario. Thanks for your time. The Iraqi military says it's killed 9 Daesh terrorists in an airstrike in the eastern province of Diyala. It says the terrorists were killed in 3 precision strikes carried out after identifying their exact whereabouts. 9 were implicated in a deadly attack on an Iraqi military base in Diyala earlier this month. 11 soldiers were killed in the assault, the deadliest attack carried out by the Daesh terror group in Iraq this year. The Takfiri terrorists seized control of large swaths of land in Iraq and Syria in 2014. Iraq's armed forces, backed by popular fighters and resistance movements, managed to fully liberate the occupied areas in 2017. Syrian government has initiated a reconciliation process for towns and villages in southern Damascus countryside. This is actually in implementation of the state's strategy to restore peace and normal life to areas that previously witnessed violence across the country. Our Syria correspondent Mohammed Ali reports.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There is an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for a negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus countryside.
A non-government organization in the United States has released a short film documenting the killing of 78 Palestinian children by Israeli forces in 2021.
Did Israeli forces kill in 2021? Israelis killed 78 Palestinian children in 2021. 61 in the Gaza Strip, 17 in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. 19 were shot and killed by live ammunition. Most were shot and killed in the context of demonstrations and did not present a direct threat to life or of serious injury.
The film, posted online, is part of a campaign to stop Washington's financial support for the Israeli regime. According to If Americans Knew, U.S. taxpayers supplied Israel with almost $5 billion in military aid last year. The NGO says Washington has provided Tel Aviv with at least $10.5 million worth of military military aid during the fiscal year 2021. It also called for Congress to show the film to its various committees to raise awareness about Israel's continued crimes against Palestinians. The regime is facing pressure from several UN agencies for its arbitrary and indefinite detention of Palestinian children. Scores of people have attended a sit-in in the Gaza Strip to support Palestinians in the Negev. Israeli regime forces have been attacking and destroying Palestinian Bedouin villages in the Negev in recent days. The event took place in the east of the enclave, which is the closest geographical point to the Negev region. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in in solidarity with Palestinians in the Negev. The event was held in the east of Gaza by Palestinian resistance factions. In recent days, the Israeli regime launched violent attacks in the Negev to evict Palestinians from their villages. Palestinians view Israeli attacks in the Negev as a continuation of the 1948 Nakba, when Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their homes during the creation of the Israeli regime.
This criminal entity will never succeed in stealing our land. Destroying the villages will not break the will of our people in the Negev. As we stand here, we say to the enemy that we will defend the Negev, like we defend all Palestinian lands.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians in the Negev suffer from continuous displacement attempts in order to uproot them from their land and homes. Every year, hundreds of Bedouin homes are razed to the ground as part of the Israeli regime's settlement expansion projects in the Negev. Hamas has called for unity among all Palestinians to fight Tel Aviv's expansionist policies.
We stand in solidarity with our brothers in the Negev who are being subjected to ethnic cleansing and apartheid. The Israeli regime is a racist regime and we will not sit idle as it attacks our people in the Negev. By attending this event, we are sending a message of unity to all Palestinians against the crimes of the Israeli regime.
The Islamic Jihad movement accused Arab regimes who normalized ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against Palestinians.
Normalization by some Arab regimes has given the Zionist enemy the green light to commit crimes against Palestinians in the Negev. Those who normalize ties with our enemy are giving legitimacy to the Zionist enemy. The Zionist enemy is a criminal and racist regime and will defend the Negev.
Palestinians have also condemned the international community's silence on Israeli crimes in the Negev.
People here vow to stand by Palestinians in the Negev who have been subjected to ethnic cleansing by the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
At least one Yemeni child has been killed in an artillery attack by Saudi-backed forces in the western province of Hodeidah. Local media said another person was injured in the assault. Saudi troops also shot dead three Yemenis and wounded four others in the northern Sa'dah province. Saudi Arabia and its allies have stepped up their attacks on Yemen in recent weeks. Riyadh launched a war on its impoverished neighbor in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The military campaign, coupled with a tight blockade, has failed to achieve that objective, but killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis. The attacks have prompted retaliatory strikes by Yemeni forces against Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The Yemeni army says its forces have downed another spy drone belonging to Saudi-led forces in Ma'arib province. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says Yemeni air defenses downed a Scan Eagle drone while flying over Ma'arib's Juba district. This comes hours after the Saudi-led military coalition conducted dozens of airstrikes in Yemen. Riyadh launched a devastating war against its impoverished southern neighbor in 2015. The conflict, coupled with a crippling blockade, has triggered a severe humanitarian crisis in the country. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, but Yemenis or Yemeni forces say they will continue their resistance until the Saudi aggression ends. South Korea says the North has fired an intermediate-range missile amid Pyongyang's missile tests in recent weeks. Japanese Coast Guard says North Korea appeared to have fired a ballistic missile which landed outside Japan's exclusive economic zone. Seoul says North Korea has taken a step closer to abandoning its self-imposed moratorium on testing long-range missiles. President Moon Jae-in also called on North Korea to stop creating tensions and return the talks. Meanwhile, Tokyo slammed the series of missiles launches as a violation of UN resolutions. If confirmed, this would be North Korea's seventh missile launch this year. North Korea, on the other hand, says its missile tests are an exercise of its right to self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. Now, Russian troops are in Belarus for joint military drills in less than 2 weeks. The Russian Defense Ministry has released footage of the arrival of its soldiers. It has also issued a statement saying the drills are aimed at practicing the coordination of allied forces. The joint exercise is set to start on Friday, or on February the 10th, I should say, for a 10-day period. This amid simmering tensions between Moscow and the West over Ukraine. NATO says it is closely watching Russian moves in Belarus. Meantime, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko says his country will go to war if Russia is attacked. Lukashenko says Belarus is prepared to host hundreds of thousands of Russian troops in case of a conflict. Italian President Sergio Mattarella has been elected to serve a second term in office. Mattarella agreed to remain president after a request by the overwhelming majority of political parties. They failed to find a compromise candidate after debating the issue for a week in parliament. Mattarella has initially said he wanted to leave the post. He was elected as the Italian president for a 7-year term in February of 2015.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It makes you want to cherish the Earth and protect it the more you see it from space, says a French astronaut calling for global cooperation to fight the climate crisis. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Andrea Germanus, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Astronaut Says, View from Above Reveals Absolutely Fragile Planet Earth. Stay tuned for more. French astronaut Thomas Pesquet says the impacts of the climate emergency are clear from space and worsening on his watch, and has expressed optimism that the kind of global cooperation that built the International Space Station can also be channeled to protect the planet he calls an oasis in the cosmos. Pesquet, a European Space Agency astronaut, made the remarks in an interview published recently at CNN. In November, Pesquet completed a 6-month mission abroad, the International Space Station. It was his second tour at ISS, following an earlier mission in 2016 and 2017. From space, an astronaut has a unique view of the fragility of planet Earth, he told the outlet. There is simply emptiness, he said, Apart from this blue ball with everything we need to sustain human life and life in general, which is absolutely fragile. It makes you want to cherish the Earth and protect it, he said, adding, the more you see it from space. According to Pesquet, the view from space also reveals the impacts of humanity's destruction of nature, such as river pollution. But the most visual, visible effect of the climate crisis, he said, is the retreat of glaciers. Compared to his earlier mission, Pesquet told CNN that on his 2021 tour, he could see a net increase in the frequency and the strength of extreme weather phenomena like hurricanes, like wildfires. He also likened the peaceful cooperation between countries that were not always friends in maintaining the space station and suggested that transferring that model to the way we deal with the environment on Earth could lead to planetary protection. Pesquet said, if we can make a space station fly, then we can save the planet. On Instagram, Pesquet has captured many remarkable images from the station documenting both Earth's beauty and the impacts of the climate crisis. In October, Pesquet described viewing the climate crisis from space and the increasing prevalence of destructive events viewable from above. Definitely the hurricanes seen from space and the forest fires, I had never seen that before, especially on my previous mission, he said. He conveyed his space view of the planetary crisis to the reporters, saying, through the portholes of the space station, we distinctly see Earth's fragility. We see the damaging effects of human activity, pollution of rivers, and air pollution. He and other astronauts on the 2021 mission also witnessed wildfires ravaging various regions, including California, which was covered in a cloud of smoke. We saw the flames with our naked eyes. Worsening impacts of the climate crisis from his tour 5 years earlier were clear, he said. The weather phenomena are accelerating at an alarming rate.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us contemplate on the words of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, regarding the prime position after him of his divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The love of Ali is a virtue which no sin can undermine, and his enmity is a vice with which no virtue is of any benefit.
Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
this
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. The religion of Islam is a religion of peace, brotherhood, fraternity, love, and kindness. The Holy Quran states clearly that suspicion towards your brothers in faith is a sin. إن بعض الظن إثم. The Quranic ayah is very clear in its purport when it says that you must not suspect your brothers in faith. You are a social being and you need to build your relationship based on trust and confidence. سُوءُ الظَّنِّ بِمَنْ لَا يَخُونُ مِنَ اللُّؤُومِ. The commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says in Ghurar al-Hakam that suspicion and pessimism towards someone who does not betray and who does not commit any act of treachery is despicable, it is abhorrible. Such a suspicion is misplaced, it is out of place. Why should you suspect someone who is not unfaithful to you? Why should you suspect someone who has not betrayed you, who has not done any act of treason? And why should you betray someone who does not commit any act of treachery? There is a saying also from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam who says, إِذَا اتَّهَمَ الْمُؤْمِنُ أَخَاهُ إِنْ مَاثَ الْإِيمَانُ فِي قَلْبِهِ كَمَا يَنْمَاثُ الْمِلْحُ فِي الْمَاءِ. If a person accuses his brother in faith of something when in fact he is not to be accused, when in fact he has not done anything wrong, his faith melts in his heart in the same way as salt melts in water. So, that is the effect of suspicion. That's the effect of accusing someone of doing wrong when in fact he is not to blame, he is innocent. So, that is one of the destructive impact of pessimism, that's one of the destructive consequences of distrust, and that's one of the impact of suspicion and pessimism. Imam Ali says also in his Ghurar al-Hakam, من لم يحسن ظنه استوحش من كل أحد. A person who does not improve his trust and a person who does not develop trust and confidence and does not improve his optimism and he is not optimist, استوحش من كل أحد. He will start fearing and feeling afraid of everyone. He will not trust anyone. He stays away from everyone because he is afraid of the people around him. While Islam commands its followers to trust each other and to assume that another's intentions are good, and it's not permissible for anyone to judge a Muslim's actions as corrupt without proper evidence for such a judgment. Unless you are certain that someone has done something wrong, it is always a duty upon you to carry out, to assume in fact, that his actions are valid, that his actions and that his intentions are good. We cannot misinterpret, we cannot misjudge someone's actions based on our suspicion. Suspicion makes you stay away from your brothers in faith, and suspicion makes you run away from your brothers in faith, while in fact you should not run away, you should get closer to your brothers in faith. Because you live in the society, you need your brother's help, you need your brother's participation in social activities. So how can you build trust without being optimistic? The commander of faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, has been reported to have said, expect good from your brothers unless something happens that makes you rule otherwise. And do not assume a word of his as evil when there is still the possibility of it being good, when there is a possibility of it being judged as positive as good. So always, this is a general principle of jurisprudence, which says that you should assume other people's actions to be good. You should give the benefit of the doubt to yourself. Do not go for the negative side. Do not think that his actions were meant to harm you. No, you should assume that his actions and his words are good, and they are meant for good. What will be the benefit of trusting other people? What is the benefit of husna dhan? When people trust each other, it increases their love towards each other and brings harmony into their lives. And the command of faithful Imam Ali wasalam, expressed the importance of trust in many ways. If you look, if you go through Ghurar al-Hakam, you will find many ahadith, many good sayings from Imam Ali wasalam. He has been reported to have said that he who trusts others gains their love and gains their confidence. And also Imam Ali wasalam says, حُسْنُ الظَّنِّ رَاحَةُ الْقَلْبِ وَسَلَامَةُ الْبَدَنِ. A person who trusts others and has positive thinking towards others, his heart and mind are at rest, and his body shall remain healthy. The well-being of the body, the well-being of the heart, and the well-being of the mind, or the sound mind, if we are to interpret it differently, they are interdependent. A person will not have a sound mind unless he has a sound, healthy body. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
There is a general principle in Islamic jurisprudence which is said Isalatu Siha. Isalatu Siha, what does it mean? Isalatu Siha actually means that we need to assume that other people's actions are good, that other people's actions are not intended for any harm, and that their actions are valid. For example, if someone is offering prayers and if someone is talking, we should not begin thinking that they are backbiting us. Because if you think that they are backbiting you, now two people are talking to each other, you are staying, let's say, a few meters away, you should not start thinking that they are backbiting you, or they are, you know, conspiring you, or they are hatching a conspiracy against you. No, you should assume that they are talking, they are asking after each other's health, and they are talking about something important. They are not backbiting you. If you keep thinking that they are backbiting you, you are not only harming yourself, you will lose your peace of mind. You will start also, you know, capitalizing. You will also do something to harm them. So there will be no trust if that's going to be the case. There will be no trust. There will be no harmony in the society, and people will cease to have their peace of mind. And they will not have any comfort. They will not have this peace of mind. They will not have tranquility of the heart, and they will lose everything. That's for sure. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert that he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every
Commercial news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
The streets in the Taiwanese capital are decorated vividly to welcome the Year of the Tiger beginning on February the 5th. Residents are using tiger sculptures and totems to adorn the streets of Taipei. Shops are booming as people head out to buy special couplets ahead of the new year, also called the Spring Festival. Many are hoping they can completely defeat COVID-19 this year, as celebrations were scaled down due to the pandemic last year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated by almost 2 billion people across the world, though mainly in Asia. There are 12 animals representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, a symbol of strength and power. A national zoo in Washington is now home to a new quill-covered resident, the second offspring of a porcupine family. Zoo staff reported the birth of the porker pet earlier this month during a snowstorm. They say they are awaiting a DNA analysis to reveal more information about the baby porcupine. Its brother is now 4 years old. The two siblings are the fourth generation of this family to live in the zoo's mammal house. These animals are born with the ability to climb and look almost identical until they are 6 months old. Natives of South America, these creatures are one of the 18 porcupine species that exist in the world today. The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately 1 million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. Now, with the Chinese New Year approaching, a Vietnamese artist is honoring the zodiac sign of 2022 by making different objects that look like tigers.
I often introduce collections for the zodiac animal of the next year. It's going to be the year of the tiger soon. There are 2,022 carvings in this collection, which align with the number of this year. Also, I am very fond of tigers as an animal, as they are so powerful, yet so majestic.
Tam Pat has his workshop in a village on the outskirts of the capital, Hanoi. The 39-year-old artist makes tigers using wood from jackfruit trees, which Vietnamese often use to make spiritual items. He applies crushed eggshells and seashells to give shape to the tiger's stripes. The artist is also carving some tigers purely out of laterite, the mineral still used in some villages to build homes. It takes Tam Pat about 2 weeks to come up with a tiger-looking object. This year, he is trying to make his creations in a way that can be used in everyday life. The house in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. Tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain momentum, some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with a novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
Iran has won the first title in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championship. Saman Kujuri has more.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square roots, cube roots, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PALMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Traveling around the world is a wish a lot of people have, but never actually get the chance. However, the Belgian-British girl has achieved that feat at only 19. Zora Rutherford flew back home on Thursday to a crowd made up of family members, friends, fans, and journalists. She completed her odyssey after just over 5 months, traveling over 52,000 kilometers. Zara is the youngest female in the world to fly around the globe. She achieved this using a microlight aircraft, which weighs only 325 kilograms and has very low fuel consumptions. That's absolutely amazing. Let's take a listen.
Right, the plane obviously is a bad for the environment. I'm not trying to claim that it is, but I have chosen one of the best aircraft to do it with. The fuel consumption is amazing. For this whole trip, it's used the same amount of fuel as a Boeing uses in about 10 minutes for the whole trip around the world, which I think puts things into perspective. Obviously, it is bad, but I'm really trying to minimize my impact as much as possible.
Zara says the scariest part of her trip was flying over the frozen expanse of Siberia, a place with no human habitation close by. The teen adventurer also had to deal with different countries' health restrictions. Zara had to take multiple PCR tests on her journey, while China's COVID-related regulations meant she could not use the country's airspace. Now, Zara says she is glad she can stay in one place for a few months. Who knows what her next adventure will be? In the world of art, a Japanese artist named Sachi is creating incredibly realistic felted wool portraits of cats. Sachi calls her artworks Wakuneko, which directly translates to frame cat. Her work is highly popular, and she has more than 600,000 followers on different social media platforms. Each portrait takes a whopping 1 month to complete. The crafting process starts with Sachi looking at dozens of photos of the cat she wants to replicate. Then she prepares the required materials before preparing the foundation and mounts the felt onto it. The most difficult part of the job is making the subject's eyes. According to Sachi, it is also the most special stage.
I think that the moment when the cat's spirit enters into the artwork can be presented through the eyes. In that sense, I have been very particular about how to make the eyes.
Sachi's portraits have inspired people around the world to adopt homeless cats. Now she hopes to hold an exhibition showing various cats, including ones with physical handicaps, in order to inspire more adoptions of shelter cats.
Disability is not an obstacle to success. A group of Japanese with disabilities has proved it as they create incredible handicraft and make a living this way. A shop called Amayaka offers the items made by these disabled individuals. Located in a Tokyo neighborhood, it showcases products ranging from scarves and bags to glassware and colorful carts. Mayaka and all other workshops are part of a new movement aimed at promoting works of people with impairment. In just one of the workshops cooperating with Mayaka, about 20 disabled people are working over there. However, organizers of the movement say these people are still invisible in the society and are not paid fairly for their works despite being experienced in craftsmanship.
Some workers here have a career of more than 30 years. They have been weaving since their school days. They are so experienced that we should refer to them as artisans.
The organizers say they hope that their initiative will promote the works of the people with disabilities and help the society to start thinking about the way disabled workers are being treated. The Indian-administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office, a 200-year-old houseboat on a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar. Set up during the British rule in India, the post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt has more.
The Indian-administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir, this allowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, houseboat on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dalek.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here. And every day, I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colorful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare Philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office.
In the age of technology, electronic mail, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Over the years, the Zionist regime has tried to uproot and expel the people of the Naqab through home demolitions and the destruction of wheat crops through aircraft chemical dispersal. It has also destroyed agricultural yields by annually bulldozing farmland while confiscating livestock and herds of goats from the Bedouin. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Amir Mahul, writer. This article is published under the heading, Why Zionist Regime is Accelerating Its Expansionist Plan in the Naqab. Stay tuned for more. A few weeks ago, the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett stood on a hilltop in the Naqab, overlooking the Palestinian Bedouin town of Rahat, and announced that the Israeli regime would shift to an attack strategy. An attack, in the Zionist regime's parlance, means a renewed onslaught on the remaining Arab presence in this part of Palestine. The area has gained a new strategic importance within the rubric of the Israeli regime economic and security plans for the area, especially those pertaining to international trade and regional relations with the United Arab Emirates and the incumbent Saudi Crown Prince, who has made a number of promises to the Zionist regime he intends to fulfill once he succeeds his father. Over the years, the Zionist regime has tried to uproot and expel the people of the Naqab through through home demolitions and the destruction of wheat crops through aircraft chemical dispersal. It has also destroyed agricultural yields by annually bulldozing farmland while confiscating livestock and herds of goats from the Bedouin. The Zionist regime has further worked to weaken and fragment the community by allowing crime and weapon sales to flourish, exhausting the inhabitants of the area and making their lives unlivable in the hopes that this would pave the way for its expansionist plans. Bennett tried to appear as if it were not directly carrying out its prime minister's orders, instead outsourcing them to one of the most important tools of Zionist colonization in Palestine, the Jewish National Fund, or JNF. Armed with rabbinical blessings, the JNF was exempted from observing the Shemitah year, the seventh year of a seven-year cycle in which Halakha, or the Jewish law, forbids any kind of agricultural activity in the Holy Land. Having been absolved of this duty, JNF had free rein to carry out its activities in the Naqab, under the justification that the planting of tens of millions of trees in the area was a grave necessity and in the interest of the Jewish people. As for the regime, its duty was to protect those newly forested areas while bulldozing 55,000 donems of Palestinian land, building artificial hills and dams, and erecting fences to keep out its owners. Then the role of the law came in when those lands became protected under forestry and agricultural ordinances. None of this is new, of course, as it is an inherent part of Zionism, embodied by the ultimate crime of the 1948 Nakba, which is a part of the regime's founding spirit and the military regime that followed until 1966. During that period, the regime used the regime of closed military zones to prevent people's return to their lands, villages, homes, and property before they became permanent refugees, either in the diaspora or in Palestine. And it bears remembering that the fake regime of Israel, having already exploited the fog of war to carry out land theft, ethnic cleansing, and massacres, has also used many of the various peace agreements with the Arab states to continue its confiscation and theft of even more land. During the Camp David Accords of 1978 with Egypt, the Zionist regime confiscated a million donems of Arab lands in the Naqab, and today it builds the strategic projects in the partnership with the Emirates for the transfer of natural gas through the Naqab to Europe. And none of this is to mention the ethnic cleansing and expulsions that take place in the Palestinian towns in the Galilee and the Naqab, both considered to have the most fertile agricultural land. Current onslaught on Palestinians' lands in the Naqab and the repression that has accompanied it constitute a war crime and a crime against humanity, as it has entailed the state-sanctioned terror and ethnic cleansing. This is how the situation should be reported to the Commission of Inquiry of the Human Rights Council, investigating the Zionist